Thanks for tuning into the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Patrick Seibel. Last month, on August 11th, we brought you the first half of a tour of the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens, guided by the illustrious David Stevens, curator of the gardens at the UW Arboretum. Tonight's show is part two of that tour, recorded on a beautiful summer day in August. Here's the show.
All right, as we walk a little further, we're coming across elm trees. If people didn't know, of course, we lost our glorious American elms to a disease called Dutch elm disease, first discovered in the Netherlands, and that's why that name is there, but originally came from Asia. What we're standing in front of is the regal elm. So the University of Wisconsin had one of the most robust elm breeding programs in the country for many years in the 70s and 80s, led by Eugene Smalley originally and his co-worker Don Lester. And what they were trying to do was breed resistance to Dutch elm disease into our American elm. American elm, of course, was really the premier street tree of the East and gave us those cathedral-like roadways that were covered by their amazing branches. It has a vase-shaped form to the tree, and that's how they would grow over streets there. So their first release is right here. It's called Regal Elm. I don't know if they got the vase shape too well or not, but it is really a sight to behold. And really shows how beloved the American elm was and what we would go to try to keep it on our landscape. As we go a little further, we can see the final release from that program here at UW. Unfortunately, Don Lester would pass, but a man named Ray Gurries, who I was lucky enough to work with for almost 14 years at the end of this elm program, who was with our forestry department here on campus, released what they call New Horizon. And as we walk over to it, I think you'll see they really nailed that vase shape that we saw and loved in the American elm. With
slender base, you mean, like a slender base?
Right, so we'd have that trunk, and then as we look up into the architecture of the actual tree, we can see it forms a vase. So the branches on the outer would grow out into a road as they used to. And you can see as we do two together, what a nice kind of canopied space we have underneath that doesn't need constant pruning from the streets department or things of that nature. Believe it or not, this New Horizon is now the most planted elm in England, which is interesting, kind of part of that Wisconsin idea as well, to do things for people outside of Wisconsin that we can share with. So that's pretty fascinating to me that they are planting that one cultivar more than others.
Now, is there, you know, when you say the vase shape, it branches out at a just my observation is that the branching occurs fairly early, and there's still a central trunk in here. Is that?
Yeah, there is still a central leader, which is something actually we want on most of our ornamental trees that resist breaking out. If we walk a little further, we may see why we don't want multiple leaders and sometimes these poor, what we call crotch angles, which are more prone to breaking. So yeah, as we look up at the New Horizon elm, we can see a central leader, and then off of that are these branches that come out at about a 45-degree angle. And then as they get farther away from the trunk, have more of a horizontal growth habit. And if we were able to take this tree out and see it without all the other nearby trees, we'd see that overall form looks like a vase with flowers in it. And so therefore the vase-shaped form to it. We have other just unique things. The one we're standing under now is our native black walnut, but you'll notice the leaves look a little different. So this is the cut-leafed a black walnut, and just, you know, a chance, a seedling that was a little different than all the rest, and just has a more graceful appearance to it than the standard form of the species. So still just the same species, but the leaves are much more finely cut and reminiscent of almost a fern, if you will. So I think of really the Longenecker collection here, we call it the living collection, as just being a repository of just the wonders that nature has to give us. And sometimes you need things that are more odd or colorful to get people's attention to that. Unfortunately, a lot of folks go about their day and trees are just trees. You come out here where we have everything labeled, you can begin to see just the grand diversity of plant material or woody plants, rather, we have here in our palette that we can grow here in Wisconsin. A lot of these things I wouldn't put out in my woodlot, say in the Baraboo Hills, but boy, would I put them in my urban yard, you bet. I think what we see here is diversity in full effect, and I think that is our future, really, with climate change, as we see more tree species being lost, ash being the sad loss we're seeing now. It's going to be the diversity of our urban trees and urban canopies that I think is going to get us through this, hopefully, just a rough spot as people are able to reel in their carbon release and stuff. But anyway, diversity of species.
Is this the walnut fruit or what is?
Yeah, so actually what we're looking at here is a horse chestnut.
Ah.
Or if you came from Ohio, we would refer to that fruit as a buckeye. So both horse chestnuts and buckeyes are in the same genus called Aesculus. The horse chestnuts are native to Europe, where the buckeyes are native here to North America. So we're actually seeing the overall fruit here of the horse chestnut. And if we were to pop that open, we would see the nut inside. The name buckeye actually comes from the indigenous cultures that lived in the Ohio River Valley as Europeans moved west. They first came across this species, and the natives would refer to that fruit or that nut as the eye of the buck. So they believed it looked like a male deer's eye, and that's where the buckeye name came from. The horse chestnut name derived really in Europe, England in particular, and that is a way to differentiate it from true chestnuts, because we need to know that horse chestnuts or buckeyes are actually poisonous. So what are they good for? Well, my predecessor would tell you at Haskus that every young child needed a buckeye in their pocket. Just felt good. They're shiny. And, you know, that's what they were good for. We're now kind of moving through. We actually are seeing the actual horse chestnut, Aesculus hippocastinum, from Europe. But we're about to walk into an area that people question me about. They say, David, you know, you said that the collection is really lumped together by genus. So all the maples together, all the oaks together, and things like that. What we're now walking into is what we refer to as the street tree collection.
David, can we stop for just a moment?
And
at this time of the year, imagine we're around what's blooming and not. There's a lot of spring flowers you mentioned, but what do we have here?
Yes, you may notice that the leaves look almost identical to that buckeye or horse chestnut we just looked at. What we are looking at is the bottle brush buckeye, which has a flower that blooms now in July into August, something very unusual. Our other Aesculus would flower in the late spring. So this is really something to behold. They're white, they're bottle brush alike as well. So that's what we're seeing. We also can see they're growing in the shade. This is a species that is native to the eastern North America. We could find this in the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida even, but it's fully cold hardy for us here. And that's another thing arboreta do. We test plants to see if they are indeed able to live in our climate. You would think something from the southeast would not be able to. Here we have it in the shade, still in bloom. And we also have a few or a couple out here in the full sun. And we can see those have already spent their flowers as well. But again, now here we are at the street trees. Kind of a unique thing. Back in the later 60s, when my predecessor first started, he had a lot more space. That's one of our issues now with only about 38 acres in the collection. We're kind of running out of room. We don't have the ability to take on a whole lot of new specimens, although we do add a few every year. Well, he would get questions in the early days. You know, people would say, what would that tree look like out along the road in front of my house? So at that point, Ed Haskus had the space here in the Longenecker collection, so he created a street. And so we can see it's obviously grass. There's no concrete or asphalt here, but he's emulating a street. And we continue to plant newer things in here that we feel could do well as a street tree. You can see there's a lot of maples. One of my favorite is off to our right here. That very upright, almost pencil thin tree is actually a pure sugar maple. It's just a chance genetics oddity, if you will, or seedling that was discovered growing in front of a graveyard in Newton, Massachusetts. For the older folks in the audience, you'll know Newton, Massachusetts as the birthplace of the fig Newton. In any case, since it was growing there, they would take cuttings from it and propagate it that way. So it maintains that amazing upright form with no true central leader, and they named it Newton's Century. So you can imagine that, certainly in the urban environment, planted around a tall building. So you don't need to be pruning it, where we would not be able to use the standard species of sugar maple. We can use this one, and it still gives us all those environmental benefits that the standard species does as well, as far as flowering, fruit production, the leaves, etc., but in a unique, compact form.
Yeah, the geometry of this is amazing. This is just shooting up like a poplar or something, or some Mediterranean landscape.
Yes.
But it's actually an unpruned maple.
Unpruned. A pure sugar maple. Again, our state tree just is genetically programmed to grow in that form. So again, some of the wonders of nature here on display in the collection.
David, can you comment on, as we look down the avenue here, some of the, there's some hanging sculptures.
There is. We like to have some art in the gardens. Oftentimes it can give people a different perspective on the same landscape they've seen over and over again, but see something a little different. We normally only work with student artists here, but this we branched out a little bit, kind of came up with this during our COVID hiatus, and we worked with a local nonprofit, Madison Public Arts, to put up a couple of pieces here. And what we're looking at is actually the seed, the winged seed, called a samara, of our native sugar maple. So those are sugar maple seeds, and we can actually see as we look at them, they're winged. A lot of us knew them as kids. We'd call them helicopters. So the larger section in the middle is the true seed itself, and then the wings on them is to help propel them to get them farther from the mother tree before they germinate. So it's a way to spread them in the environment.
And this, there's two seeds in each of these sculptures here. Is that, but But as a kid, I remember you throw these up and they're individual.
Right. So we'd throw them up. Some are individual. Actually, a true Samara is a single winged seed. So this is a little variation on that. But yes, if we threw that up, it would still do that helicoptering away. And that's what they evolved to do, to be released from the tree and up in the canopy and then have the wind blow them or helicopter them away. The sculptures we're seeing, there are three of them, and they were designed to actually spin, to give you that sense of helicoptering in the wind. And they're oriented in three different ways to make sure that they would catch a breeze. Again, we're out here, fortunately, with no breeze, or we would be hearing that in the microphone. But if you come out on a windy day, you'd see them go. We worked with a local arborist as well to ensure the fact that the cables that we see attached to the trees will not harm them. So when we take this down, we won't see any death or damage to those trees. And two, the material is airplane aluminum, so quite light, yet quite sturdy as well. We've barely gotten into half of the collection here, but let's go look at one of the most amazing sites that I think we'll have perhaps today, especially when you realize the amazing history that you see standing in front of you. We're walking now up towards our conifer collection, again referred to as a pinetum. You'll see that it's on a gently sloping hill, and that is actually a glacial landscape form called the drumlin. And so we know that glaciers worked really almost as bulldozers. So as they expanded, they pushed soil and debris in front of them. And as they retracted, as they melted, they left those things behind. So as we stand here, oh boy, a few hundred feet from that drumlin, we're standing on a different soil type. So that's what we also see in these glaciated landscapes. You can have very different soil types within a very compact area. So here we're on a loamy soil, a silt loam. As we walk onto that drumlin, it's almost pure sand. My predecessors both realized that sandy areas were better for conifers. Most conifers prefer these mineralized, low nutrition soils. And they also found out over time that drumlin is slightly more acidic. So where we stand here, a few hundred feet to the west of that drumlin, we're about a pH of 7. As we go up onto the drumlin, it goes down to a pH of about 6.5 or 6, which is also very good for conifers in general.
I wasn't aware of the other part. I mean, the other pines that have fared very well, the white pines.
Yeah, so actually the largest conifers we can see standing here are white pines as well, and those are from that same era planting. Those were also planted in 1937 to kind of kick off this pinetum extension here, but give us just that great backdrop with that very almost artistic architecture to them as they've lost branches to windstorms and whatnot, snowstorms through the years. They get, I think, even more graceful. But let's walk just over a little bit to the west and, or rather the east and south of this glacial drumlin to see really one of America's wonders that unfortunately is now gone in its native habitat. What we are seeing in front of us is a very large tree with very glossy green foliage that if we get closer to, we'll see the edges are serrated, almost tooth-like. But also what grabs our eye are these light green, almost lime green, very spiny.
Can I touch this one?
You can touch them and you'll see why I refer to them as tree anemones. And what we are looking at is the fruit of the American chestnut. The American chestnut was the predominant tree species in the forests of the East. If we were to go out in the forest, we know these trees were derived from trees bought from New York State by a young man named Oscar Beardsley, who was starting a family on his farm in Galesville, Wisconsin. He bought the parents of these in 1876. In 1876, we're told one in three to one in four trees in the forests of the East and Northeast in particular was an American chestnut. Even more so, they say up to 50% of the forest canopy was American chestnut. If we go out there today, we will not see any. Or if we do, if we are lucky enough to find them, they will be very small saplings, never to attain their full size. So the chestnut, too, if we had come out just a couple of weeks before, they are in glorious bloom always right around 4th of July. And they are covered in white catkins. Catkins are the male flower that produces pollen. In general, when we see a tree with catkins, think of birches perhaps, that tells us that they're wind pollinated. Well, the American chestnut is not only wind pollinated, but we have also seen on the flowers, the female flowers here, everything from flies to the federally endangered rusty patch bumblebee. So they have a very unique pollination strategy, both using wind and pollinators, to ensure that they have a bumper crop of nuts every single year. So, and we can look here, and I think Patrick can agree that this is completely full of these seed balls on here. Each one of these will have three seed inside of it. They're fully edible. You can eat them raw, or most people like to roast them a little bit, like the Nat King Cole song tells us. And what that does is caramelizes the sugars within and makes them even more tasty. A lot of people come out in hopes of finding a few nuts to take home for the holidays when they do fall in the late summer, early fall, only to find that those aforementioned turkeys, along with our very large deer population, have eaten virtually all of the seed.
You got to beat them to the punch here.
You do. But this spiny covering on these seed pods, if you will, are there to prevent things like squirrels from eating them before they're fully ripe. So another strategy to ensure that they have a lot of nuts that actually fully ripen. Why do we have them here? Well, we have four pure American chestnuts here. It's because chestnuts were not native to Wisconsin. They came from the East and just occurred in the farthest east of Michigan. And then they also spotted into a couple of areas in far southern Illinois. Closest I really got to us was Ohio, Indiana, and whatnot. But we are isolated. So they grow just fine here. But when the disease came, first discovered in 1904 at the Bronx Zoo, so we know it came in through the port of New York. It's another Asiatic disease that came in most likely on pallet wood or some other type of wood product and then quickly spread. So it was first discovered in 1904. By 1944, all the chestnuts were dead. They estimate 3 billion trees lost. But again, chestnuts were not native here. We are isolated. We have predominantly, most people probably know that, a westerly wind, which also helped blow the disease back out east. The disease is a fungus. And then we have that nice large lake, Lake Michigan, that also divides us from the rest of the population here. Again, these are pure American chestnuts. They have no resistance to the chestnut blight. Again, I mentioned that these trees, their parents were actually bought in 1876, planted in Galesville, Wisconsin. There were 34 of them. In the 1950s, another gentleman bought the property named Einar Lunde. He was a retired mechanic from the Galesville area. and was a smart and shrewd man. He found those 34 chestnuts in a row and almost immediately began selling the seed. A researcher that was then working at the Forest Products Lab on a campus named Harry Tiedemann heard about Einar and his chestnuts in 1955. He drove out to Galesville, bought some chestnut seed from Einar, came back, and he gave a few to Bill Longenecker. Bill put those seeds, germinated them in our little nursery here at the Arboretum, and left them there. In 1969 and 1970, his successor, Ed Haskus, saw them there and thought it was time to put them out. So in 1969 and 1970, he planted the four chestnuts we see in front of us today. If you do come out and see them in bloom, or come out and look for a nut or two, you'll see that we have a little bit of the genetic diversity of the wild population they came from. So they flower a little bit different times, and the nuts are, they ripen slightly at different times as well. You know, not all is sunny and rosy. Those original 34 trees in the Galesville area, they were allowed to spread between that 1955 and 2010. They estimated 3,000 trees on that property in Galesville. Well, by 2012, unfortunately, somebody inadvertently brought the fungus with them on their shoes or their clothing, and all of those 3,000 chestnuts are dead and dying as we speak today. So knock on wood, nothing's happened to our chestnuts yet, but one never knows. So if you want to see what was once the predominant tree species of the Northeast, do come out, and they're pretty easy to find. They're at the base of that pinetum. Look for the state tree of Colorado, the Colorado blue spruce, and they are directly to the south of that.
David, what would you recommend for people that are coming to visit? You pointed out some beautiful sights here. What should we do for people that want to come here and enjoy the garden?
Sure. Well, you know, most people come during either the spring when we have all of our glorious spring flowering plants in full effect. And then we get people, just about as the same amount of people in the fall for fall color. What I recommend, come out during the growing season right now. There aren't many people out here. We do actually have some amazing flowers you can still find. They're a little more dispersed out here. But what you'll find is a lot more tranquil landscape. And it gives you more time to actually get to know some of the other plants that we have growing here instead of just the lilacs, crabapples, and magnolias. Again, most people miss the fact that we have these American chestnuts because they're not out here at the end of June and July. So I encourage people to come out actually all year round. Our conifer collection, as we're looking over underneath the chestnuts at, is just a winter wonderland. Realize you can cross-country ski out here in the collection, and to come out here in the winter too, and specifically come into our Pinetum, our conifer collection, it just is otherworldly. Think of this now with some snow in the trees, on those needles, as well as under it. You'd think you were a million miles away from Madison, or at least hundreds of miles away further up north. So I encourage people to come out at other times of the year. As I mentioned, spring and fall are the big times when you're going to be in here with thousands of other people. But right now, as we stand here, I don't see a person around us. And this is just glorious to be able to be here and just get away from it all just with a couple of mile bike ride in.
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful oasis within the city here. A gorgeous garden. Thank you so much for your work here.
Well, it's my pleasure. And again, I thank Michael Ulbrich for having that really epiphany back in the 20s and seeing that he could see this far into the future the need for a green space for Madison. I'm sure he could never imagine the actual number of people here today compared to then, but here we are reaping his foresight.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure, absolutely.
We've been speaking with David Stevens, curator for the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens at the UW Arboretum. I'm Patrick Seibel. Special thanks to my Wart colleagues, Sholly Pittman and Nate Wiegehaupt, for production assistance. Thanks for listening. Have a great night.